Hello and welcome to the Iota Unum podcasts from the Latin Mass Society. In the company of some great friends of tradition from around the world, we will be drilling into some of the fundamental issues affecting us today in the church and the world.
This is a subject in which I've had considerable interest for many, many years. I think most people here probably know me by reputation, if not actually in person. I'm a convert from the Church of England, so I wasn't brought up with the baggage, if I can put it that way, that a lot of Catholics are brought up with. I had my own baggage, which was Anglican baggage, if I can put it that way. And of course, the issue for Anglicans is quite an important one, the Queen having an important role to play in the Church of England. So one might say, well, doesn't that give you a particular bias on the subject? Well, perhaps it does. But bear in mind, unlike most born and bred Catholics, or for that matter, most born and bred Anglicans, I crossed the Tiber. I made a decision to change a lot of my fundamental views, or at least to develop them so that they came to their logical conclusion. And that means that I hope, at any rate, that you will find when you read the book that those parts, at any rate, that I have written, which I'm sure are by no means the best parts, are at least written from the point of view of objectivity. Now, happily, you will know, this is the octave of the Epiphany, the Feast of the Three Kings. So it's an auspicious day or evening in which we have this particular book launch. But some of you will also know that I was born in Australia. I'll let out a little secret. I'm actually a fifth generation Australian. No, I did not go out. Well, my ancestors did not go out with a ball and chain. They actually went out to administer the people who were wearing balls and chains, for good or ill. I won't talk about the other members of the family who went to Jamaica, where they had, shall we say, they had people working for them whom nowadays you perhaps don't want to admit about. I will leave it at that. But having said that, some of you will have read in the newspapers, quite by chance, I'd like to say I was responsible for organising this, but it would be untrue, the Prime Minister of Australia, a member of the Australian Labour Party, who are definitely on the left, has recently decided, in fact, I think only a matter of days ago, to cancel or not to hold a referendum on the Republic in Australia. Why? Because he's afraid he's going to lose it very substantially. As indeed he lost a recent referendum on the issue of native voting for a native parliament by 60%, I might add. So it's that makes it an auspicious occasion as well. Now, I'm very happy to not only ask you to read the particular section which I wrote myself, but also all the other essays in this book, all of which are excellent in my humble estimation. Sorab's very interesting, indeed fascinating, analysis of the coronation ritual as a kind of humiliation of the monarch-to-be, which in turn is an imitation, if you like, and representation of the humiliation of Christ. Fascinating essay, which I hadn't considered myself before, and he gave me a whole new perspective on that. Excellent article by Joseph Shaw on material non-cooperation with evil, which is actually at the heart, philosophically, of what my section of the book is about. And among us all, Joe is uniquely qualified to provide that particular chapter because he himself is a philosopher, which I'm not. Peter Day Milne, who's here, I think, tonight, writing on the vocation of the monarch, is also a fascinating essay. And Charles Coulomb, our American monarchist friend, writing about the American friends of the monarchy, going right the way back to a certain event, which we prefer not to dwell on, in 1776. So they're all very interesting essays, and I hope you will enjoy them. My particular contribution is, I suppose, as a lawyer, which is what I am. As you know, I'm a barrister, former army officer, so that gives me, I suppose, a bit of a perspective on the monarchy. But my interest has always been The issue of the monarchy in particular, as it and its occupant were criticised by many Catholics. Now, when I first became a Catholic, I did my best to put the best possible construction on what I was being told by my new co-religionists. And most of them, I discovered, and I shouldn't have been surprised, but I suppose I was a bit, were of Irish extraction, or Hibernian, shall we say. And it took me a long time to realise it, but eventually I did. The penny did drop. You might say, well, more fool you for being so slow to pick it up, but there it was. But the average Hibernian Catholic, and let us not forget, 40% of the Anglophone Catholic world are of Hibernian descent, and I'm sure some of you here are. I should personally say, in case you think I've got a particular thing about the Irish, my great-grandmother was a Lynch from West Cork. That's about as Republican as it gets, I think. I've got no fish to fry on this, and I should add, I've been shooting in Ireland for 23 years, and I don't mean Irish. Although I did serve in Northern Ireland when I was in the army. I mean shooting their birds, and very excellent birds they are, too. So I actually...
The feather variety,
yes. I have a particular warmth towards Ireland and the Irish. I very much enjoy going there, and I enjoy being with them. Joe will forgive me for telling that age-old joke, but what is the difference between an Irish and an English pub? If you stand up in an English pub and start singing, in about 2 or 3 minutes, somebody will go over to the barman and say, would you tell that fellow to shut up? Whereas in Ireland, a small semicircle will form in front of you, and when you finish singing, they will say, do you know this one, mister? And ask you to sing another song. And I kid you not, that is the difference. So I very much enjoy going over there and singing. And they tolerate it, which they certainly don't do in this country. But I discovered that you could be talking to a Hibernian Catholic, if I may describe them thus, and I don't mean any kind of offence by saying so, but they were brought up as they were brought up. And you would be talking perfectly rationally. You might be talking about science or medicine or the law or politics or anything. And you are talking perfectly rationally with this individual, finding that you agree with him 100% and slapping each other on the back to the extent to which one agrees until you get onto the subject of the monarchy. And then, as I have been accused of saying many times and I will say again, a green mist descends. And you find that you're talking to somebody who you might be forgiven for thinking had recently escaped from a lunatic asylum. You just simply cannot speak to them on the subject rationally. They have been taught from a very, very early age that British monarchy is Antichrist personified. And there is, the sooner you can get rid of it from your country, the better. And all those IRA heroes are all heroes. And yes, it's perfectly all right to go around murdering people, so long as it's to get rid of the British monarchy, and so on and so on. You, I'm sure, know better than me. It's for a long time, I thought, well, there must be something here I don't understand. Well, actually, I eventually discovered, no, there isn't. It's very simple. They have been taught from a very early age what is really no more than simple racist bigotry, I regret to have to say. So, how does that affect the whole issue of the monarchy? Well, essentially what it boils down to is this. And this is not simply Hibernian Catholics who have a particular bias against the British monarchy, but English Catholics too, Scottish Catholics, Welsh Catholics, and indeed Catholics worldwide, will come up to me and say, when I'm having a debate about this, yes, but Queen Elizabeth II was responsible for all that evil legislation. She signed it into law. How can you possibly defend that? And it's a perfectly fair question. Unlike the sort of green mist bigotry, that is a fair question. And that is one I have sought to answer in this book. And without spoiling the effect of it, when you read it, because it is a slightly technical subject, and you'll forgive me for having gone into the technical detail as a lawyer, because frankly you have to in order to be able to answer the question, the reality is simply this. The British monarchy, for good or ill, has not had the power to veto legislation for 300 years. since the so-called Glorious Revolution of 1688, which threw out our last Catholic king, King James II of England and Ireland, and the 7th of Scotland. And he was thrown out because he was Catholic, basically. And thereafter, seizing the opportunity not only to get rid of a Catholic king, but to put in place, and to put in place a Protestant king, the grandees also seized the opportunity to make Parliament, by which I mean the House of Lords and the House of Commons, sovereign over the monarch. Now, you and I may say, what a disaster, what a mistake. But that is our constitution for good or ill, and has been since 1688. Now, some people say, oh, hang on a minute, didn't William of Orange veto some legislation? Actually, Queen Anne did in 1708. She vetoed the Scottish Militia Bill. It's true. But she did so, and so did William, on the advice of her ministers, not on her own initiative or his own initiative. And the advice of ministers is a constitutional fiction, which really means orders of ministers. But of course, it's regarded as unseemly to say that ministers of the crown, or indeed Parliament for that matter, order the king or queen to do A or B. So we use this rather polite constitutional fiction of saying advises the monarch, but the law and the constitution say the monarch must follow that advice. And that has been the situation since 1688. In 1708, when Queen Anne vetoed the Scottish Militia Bill, the reason it was done is because the Scottish Militia Bill was put through in haste in order to build up a militia in Scotland to be able to defend Scotland from those Jacobites who wished to restore the Stuart monarchy. But then they discovered, to their horror, in Westminster, that the Scottish militia was likely to be more Jacobite than it was pro-Hanoverian. And so they said, well, what the heck are we going to do? We don't want to have to go through the whole business of repealing it. I know, we'll advise the Queen to veto the legislation. That is what happened. So it wasn't Queen Anne saying, I don't like that piece of legislation. I'm not going to give my consent to it, my assent, the royal assent, as it's called. It was ministers advising her to refuse royal assent. And that is still very much a live issue. Because when Boris Johnson was Prime Minister, he was seriously considering advising the Queen to refuse royal assent to a bill that had gone through both Houses of Parliament, because it was all in relation to the issue of Brexit. He decided in the end that he wasn't going to do that. Sir Jacob Rees-Mogg got up in the House and said, we are a constitutional government, we always abide by the Constitution, we would never dream of doing that. Which rather begged the question as to whether it was constitutionally correct or not. In fact, of course, it might well have been. However, something like 39 leading professors of law and KCs, including Dinah Rose, KC, who's a very well-known Jewish KC, and Lord Panic, another famous KC, also Jewish, no laughter from you. I'm Jewish too, by the way, so you better be careful with what you say. And they are both regarded as being at the top of the profession. And all of them said, this will be an outrage. This cannot be done. It's unconstitutional. Well, I'm not sure about that. But what is not in doubt is that the Queen could not act on her own initiative and has not been able to do so, nor her predecessors, for 350-odd years, since 1688. And that is our constitution. Except there is, by common consent, one exception. Because the obvious question, the obvious point to make as a result of what I've just said is, well, what's the point of the monarch then? I mean, if she can't do anything, if she's just got a, she's just a figurehead who's told what to do, is it just that she's a tourist attraction, or that she looks good for special occasions like the opening of Parliament, or for making speeches, broadcasting speeches at Christmas time? No. There is one exception which most constitutional lawyers and academics accept, where the monarch has the right under the Constitution to refuse a bill on his or her own initiative. And it is vital to the safety of our Constitution. What is it? It is a bill that would destroy the Constitution, i.e. a bill which would extend the life of Parliament indefinitely, in other words, abolish elections, or a bill that would gerrymander the electorate so that only the governing party could ever get back in, which would again be a destruction of our Constitution and, to put it in more user-friendly terms, our democracy. Or another, and probably the only other, example, where a Prime Minister who had lost the confidence of the House of Commons refused to stand down. Those are three examples of where our Constitution would be, in effect, compromised fatally if such a bill were allowed to go through both Houses of Parliament. Now, bear in mind, when we use the term Parliament, it is shorthand for the Crown in Parliament. So we've got to be careful when we use that term. But here I mean by Parliament the House of Commons and the House of Lords, and sometimes not the House of Lords, because bear in mind there's the Parliament Act by which the House of Commons and the Prime Minister can short-circuit the House of Lords under the Parliament Act 1911-1949 and go straight to royal assent. And in those circumstances, if a bill has been through both Houses of Parliament, or one if the Parliament Acts have been brought into play, all that the Crown does, except in that circumstances, that exceptional circumstances I set out, is to certify, in effect, that the bill has gone through both Houses of Parliament, or if the Parliament Act has been brought into play, the lower house, the governing house. And all the machinery of royal assent is carried out not at Buckingham Palace, not in any royal office, but in the minister's office, whether it's the Prime Minister or whether it is the minister in charge of the particular legislation. All that happens is his staff prepare the papers, and all that happens then is that he advises the Queen or the King to certify that the bill has gone through both Houses of Parliament. And that is effectively what the Crown does. So it's a rubber stamping exercise, unless and until it's an issue of saving the Constitution. And for that purpose alone, the Crown is worth preserving. Because obviously, nothing can be more important than preserving our Constitution. I should just say, before I finish, if Germany had had a king in 1933 or 1934, so that when Adolf Hitler attempted to destroy the Constitution by merging the offices of Chancellor and President into the office of Führer, and by all the other steps that he took to undermine the Weimar Constitution, the king could have refused his assent in exactly the same way as a British monarch. And in fact, the German king, up until the establishment of the Weimar Republic, had more powers than does our present monarch. I don't need to tell you, the result would have been something very beneficial to mankind. But it did not happen. Why? Because President von Hindenburg died, and in order to get another president in a republic, you have to have an election. And exploiting the gap between the death and the election, Hitler was able to destroy, in effect, the German Constitution, and we know the rest of the story. So there is a moral tale which I think has a lot of resonance in relation to this issue of the monarchy. The other issue is, what is the difference between the position of the monarch and the power of the monarch, and that of, let us say, the Irish president? Under paragraph 13.11 of the Irish Constitution, nothing. The Irish president has no more power to veto legislation than does His Majesty. All he can do, which the King can't do because we do not have a constitutional court, is to refer a bill to the Irish Supreme Court to determine whether or not it is constitutional. And that's all. Otherwise, the Irish president is simply in the same position as the monarch. He certifies that the bill has gone through both houses of the Oireachtas, the Dáil and the Síne. That's all. Now, why, therefore, isn't there the same level of criticism of the Irish presidency and the Irish Republic as there is of the monarchy. Because the monarch is a soft target. Because monarchy is not fashionable. But not for any rational or logical reason. And yet there it is. And it's more or less the same in most other republics around the world. The exceptions are the United States, where the president has a very real veto, and some would say is in effect a kind of monarch, an elective monarch. And so I'm told, or I don't know for certain, the Italian Republic, where apparently the Italian president has some power to veto legislation. But otherwise, nearly every other republic in the world is in no different position from that of the monarch. So if one changes from a monarchy to a republic, it doesn't make any difference. The head of state still has no more power than His Majesty. Therefore, why is he the subject of criticism? But the advantage is the one I have just outlined, which is when the king dies, they always traditionally used to say, the king is dead, long live the king. Because immediately upon his death, his successor becomes king, with all the powers that the king has to prevent the death of constitutional democracy. Whereas in a republic, you have to wait for an election, and therefore you have this gap. Now, please God, in most republics, there will not be an exploitation of that gap in the same way that there was in Germany in 1934. But there could be, but not in a monarchy. So there's yet another advantage to having a monarch and a monarchy. So those are the sorts of arguments which are developed and which I try to develop in the bill. There are other criticisms of the monarchy by other authors. And what we have done is to address criticisms of other articles, other authors who have written on the subject, precisely so that it's not an academic, purely academic exercise, but is actually addressing criticisms, cogent criticisms, made by other authors of the monarchy, so that we can say, right, these are the criticisms, this is how we answer it, rather than simply talking in an academic vacuum. And so that is why we have chosen that particular format, and we've chosen various Catholic authors, all of them, to address their arguments and to defend the position of the monarch. So, that's what we've done, and I hope you will enjoy it. Thank you very much.
This podcast was brought to you by the Latin Mass Society. We hope you enjoyed it and would appreciate your rating the podcast on the platform you are using. If you would like to find out more, do visit our website and consider joining us or giving us a donation.